We are reading in Srimad Bhagavatam, Canto 2, Chapter 7, Scheduled Incarnations with Specific Functions. This is text number 13. Brahma now tells a little bit about Kurma Avatar, Lord Tortoise. Translation: the primeval Lord then assumed the tortoise incarnation in order to serve as a resting place or pivot for the Mandara mountain, which was acting as a churning rod. The demigods and demons were churning the ocean of milk with the Mandara mountain in order to extract nectar. The mountain moved back and forth, scratching the back of Lord Tortoise, who, while partially sleeping, was experiencing an itching sensation. Srila Prabhupada's purport: although it is not in our experience, there is a milk ocean within this universe. Even the modern scientist accepts that there are hundreds and hundreds of thousands of planets hovering over our heads, and each of them has different kinds of climatic conditions. Srimad Bhagavatam gives much information which may not tally with our present experience. But as far as Indian sages are concerned, knowledge is received from the Vedic literatures, and the authorities accept without any hesitation that we should look through the pages of authentic books of knowledge, Shastra Chakshurvat. So we cannot deny the existence of the ocean of milk, as stated in Srimad Bhagavatam, unless and until we have experimentally seen all the planets hovering in space. Since such an experiment is not possible, naturally we have to accept the statement of Srimad Bhagavatam as it is, because it is so accepted by spiritual leaders like Sridhar Swami, Jiva Goswami, Vishwanath Chakravarti, and others. The Vedic process is to follow in the footsteps of great authorities, and that is the only process for knowing that which is beyond our imagination. The primeval Lord, being all-powerful, can do whatever he likes, and therefore his assuming the incarnation of a tortoise or a fish for serving a particular purpose is not at all astonishing. Therefore, we should not have any hesitation whatsoever in accepting the statements of the authentic scriptures like Srimad Bhagavatam. The gigantic work of churning the milk ocean by the combined effort of the demigods and the demons required a gigantic resting ground or pivot for the gigantic Mandara hill. Thus, to help the attempt of the demigods, the primeval Lord assumed the incarnation of a gigantic tortoise swimming in the ocean of milk. At the same time, the mountain scratched his backbone as he was partially sleeping and thus relieved his itching sensation. So this, later on in Bhagavatam, quite a few chapters in the eighth canto are spent telling this pastime of the Lord in detail. Again, it takes place in this interplanetary warfare between the devatas and the asuras. This is part of the history of the universe. Another thing that is quite beyond our experience, coming down to us in Bhagavatam, is this history of the universe, which of course Prabhupada has to deal with. People who reject all of this. We are products of the enlightenment, the Aufklärung. And at least in Europe, people decided, hey, let's start over from scratch. Let's reject all received traditional knowledge handed down by scripture and authorities and start all over again and build humanity anew based on reason and our own experimental knowledge. What's called the Enlightenment. More like just the opposite, but that's what happened. And so this the Enlightenment project has been going on to this very day. Modern science is a product of the Enlightenment. It was based on this idea of we'll reject everything and start over again. The philosopher Descartes said, let me doubt everything there is to be doubted. How can we have certain knowledge? We cannot be sure. If our received knowledge through traditions and authority is reliable. Because, you know, up until that time, there was a similar system. There was the authority, there was a revelation of Scripture, there were the great thinkers of the past. Either there were some secular thinkers who were regarded as quite authoritative, especially Aristotle and Plato. And then there was the Bible, and then there was the... After that, there was Saint Augustine and Thomas Aquinas and the great sages who studied this revelation on the basis of reason and logic, and tradition accepted the authority and passed it down. And then something happened. Something happened. It all fell apart. You had this beginning anew, oh, we'll start all over again. Like Descartes. Let me doubt everything there is to be doubted. How can I trust even my own sense perception, he says. How do I know that there's not some demon out there that's feeding me false data? Like that movie, The Matrix. But Descartes had this idea that there's some bad guy out there who may be systematically misleading us. So I can't. So this was the Enlightenment spirit, and it kept on going. One of the French Enlightenment thinkers, one of his statements was that, and it turned into a political program. Because what about priests? What about kings? What's their authority? How do they have power over us? How do they guide our knowledge? Where does it come from? These are just the oppressors. Diderot said, mankind will never be free until the last king is strangled by the intestines of the last priest. And on the basis of this kind of thinking, you know, you had the United States Constitution, all based on Enlightenment ideas. Of course, there was the French Revolution, which was one of the outcomes of this Enlightenment thinking, and so on. There was almost immediately after the Enlightenment, there was something that the historians call the Counter-Enlightenment. Some thinkers, especially in Germany, reacted heavily against this. And one of them was a German poet named Novalis, just at the juncture of the 17th and 18th century. He didn't live very long. He wrote under the name of Novalis. And I happened to run across a poem of his. He was a mining engineer, so he was like trained in science, but he was also quite a mystic, and looking for something. And he has one poem where he almost prophesizes a day. He says, nicht mehr zählen und figuren sind schlimm. When he's talking about a time when numbers and figures will no longer be considered the key to all beings, you know, like this. When there's a group of people who know how to sing and to embrace, and those people, by singing and embracing, will be wiser than the most learned scholar. like this, it goes on like this. It sounds like a prophecy of the Hare Krishna movement, especially when it comes to the line, "Un man in Märchen und Gedichten kennt die wahre Weltgeschichte," and people will see. In Märchen means like folk tales or fairy tales, and in Gedichten and in poetry, they will recognize the true history of the world. Yeah. I always think of that when I read Bhagavatam. They'll recognize the true history of the world. And there's all these conditions, and the climax is, and he says, and then on the utterance of a single secret word, this entire perverted existence will be dissolved. This is an amazing poem, you know. Anyway, so we are counter enlightenment people. There's a book I read by scholars called Understanding Mantras, and the scholar, mundane scholars, and he was talking about he said, modern scholars, we have trouble with mantras. He said, we accept the enlightenment consensus, he said. We do not believe in magic. Most of us do not pray, and so on. This is the enlightenment consensus. We do not believe in magic, that you could say some syllables and it would be efficacious. You know, it's like... Anyway, here's the true history of the universe. We do have an alternative history that's given that this Bhagavatam is the product of a superior culture, much higher, more advanced culture than we are, and we people from inferior, degraded culture. After all, when Kali Yuga began, everyone began to suffer from brain damage, and so our level of intelligence has dropped. So we are like people from a very inferior, degraded species trying to understand the product of a much higher and superior culture. But although we're degraded and inferior, we think we're the greatest. We think no one has been as great as we are. We think that before us showed up, there were just apes, and somehow or other we became the best of the apes. And there was nothing before us, and now human civilization, which is our creation, we made it ourselves, we created ourselves, we're continually improving ourselves, and now things have never been better. So what do we see when we see this? Oh, this comes from the infancy of the human race. We were just in the nursery, in the playpen, and we dreamed so many fantasies. We imagined, what amazing imagination these people had. You know? It was like little children. We think it's the product of inferior people. According to this history, there is a cosmic interplanetary battle going on since the beginning of time between two great powers rule most of space. There's two spaces. There's the space that we see, which is ruled by the devatas, the heavens, svarga. Svarga, the word svarga sort of means wide open space, and they're called heavens, where the controllers, the bureaucrats of the universe, the cosmic bureaucrats, the cosmocrats, run things on behalf of the Lord. And then, as it turns out, there's another svarga down below, Bila svarga, the svarga in a hole. Bila means a hole. Now imagine the experience of going into a cave, for example. You're in a little narrow, dark place, and then all of a sudden it opens up and there's vast spaces. And it's dark, but sometimes there's phosphorescent light down there. This is like Bila Svarga, only, of course, it's cosmic. You go down through Bhumandala. It blocks the sunlight. There's Bhumandala spread across the universe. You go down, and then there's wide open spaces. There is no sunlight there. It cannot penetrate. This is the place that the Daityas and the Danavas inhabit. We have a whole tour of Bila Svarga in the Bhagavatam, the different planets, who's there, what they do. The light is, it's snake light. At the very bottom, like you sometimes find in a cave, there are lots of snakes. These are these nocturnal snakes who have jewels on their foreheads. That's where the light comes from. Light emitting jewels. These snakes come up out of there sometimes. There's a snake in this pastime, Vasuki. He keeps being used as a rope. he's one of the leaders of the snakes. They're nagas, known as nagas, otherwise known as dragons. They're known as dragons. And China, they're regarded as, that part of the world, they're regarded as auspicious. And in the other side, the European side, they're regarded as inauspicious. So St. Michael, St. George, they're always killing dragons. A dragon is just a naga. What they are is this way and that way, not so auspicious. Krishna had to deal with Kali and Naga, but then also there's Anantashesha, who's a Naga also. So anyway, that brings a whole other topic up about. So there's this warfare going on between these two groups. The demons, they have very advanced technology, the asuras, the main group is called the Daityas. That means they're the offspring of Diti. Whereas the Devatas are the offspring of Diti's sister, Aditi. Both have the same father, Kashyapa. In other words, this warfare is between half-brothers. It's like a civil war. They're relatives. They're relatives. They're related, and the Devas are running the universe on behalf of the Supreme Lord. Their battle commander is Indra. Their king and their battle commander, and the Daityas, many other the Danavas. And they keep trying to take over. They have technology. They have Vedic knowledge. Somehow they get a hold of it because they have Shukracharya. Remember, there's always a big concern that the demons don't steal the Vedas, because then they use it. And then it becomes, when demons have Veda, it becomes material technology. So they have these big technicians like Maya Danava, who builds cities and spaceships and UFOs and things like that, to fly in outer space for these things. So here's an early incident in this combat. Indra, who's the head of the Devatas, and is a devotee, is nevertheless prone to be influenced by his big position and his enjoying propensity. They're Sakama devotees. So periodically, they have the weakness that he gets proud, and then he disrespects sometimes his own guru, Brihaspati, the Lord had to bail out the Devatas from their problem when Indra did not stand up when Brihaspati came into his courtyard. Brihaspati was offended and left, and then the demons became strong because they really worshipped Shukracharya really nicely, and he gave them all kinds of technical knowledge, like when somebody gets killed, how to bring them back to life again, and so on. So they became very strong, and that's when Lord Vamana finally came in and intervened in this battle. The reason this battle is interesting is that Krishna always appears, and frequently, always, not always, but regularly appears in the middle of it. It says that just as when you rub two pieces of wood together, fire comes out, so the friction between the demons and the demigods, Vishnu comes out, because he intervenes on behalf of the demigods. The demons, in many ways, are materially more powerful, and so the Lord has to intervene periodically. So he does this time. The beginning of this incident involved another sage, Durvasa Muni. Indra was riding by on his elephant, quite proud and thinking how great he was and everything like that. And Durvasa Muni offers Indra his garland. So Indra takes it and very negligently drapes it over the elephant, not realizing it. This is a real special garland to get from Durvasa Muni. The elephant grabs it with his trunk and throws it down and tramples it. So Durvasa Muni curses Indra. This Vedic culture where curses actually work, that he would lose power and strength and become poor. So then the demons at that time, their commander was the grandson of Prahlad Maharaj, Bali. And by the way, this also takes place in the Chakshusha millennium, the previous Chakshusha Manvantara, the previous Manu. And so it looks like Indra is really upset. They're losing. The demigods are. They had a battle with the demons, and the demons use something that's called the snake weapon. And they really killed a lot of the demigods. They couldn't be revived. Usually they're Amara. They have remarkable recuperative powers, but they could not recuperate. They were dead. So with great concern, they approached Lord Brahma. All the demigods, including Brahma, he has a city at the top of Mount Sumeru. So they went to the top of the mountain, told him what the problem was, and then Brahma meditates on the Lord, and then goes with some of the demigods to the localized Vaikuntha planet where there's a milk ocean, and they receive the message that the Lord said he's going to appear. And he appears as Ajita during this time. He appears as Ajita. And the Lord gave them advice that you should make a truce with the demons and work with them together, because what you need to be really increase your longevity and your strength and your ability to be invincible in this battle is Amrita. This Amrita, we translate it as nectar. It's a drink that gives, you know, exceptional longevity and vitality and so on. And I'll tell you how to get this Amrita, but you need the cooperation of the Danavas. They'll want it too. And they'll think they can get it from you. Because what you have to do is you have to churn the ocean of milk. And this is a gigantic project. like a huge, you know, like building the Aswan Dam or something in Egypt, like one of these monumental projects on a huge scale. So you, both of you, are going to have to participate to churn it. So make a truce. And he said, but we'll, you should follow the example of the snake and the mouse, because the snake and the mouse are usually at odds, because the mouse is food for the snake. But the snake and the mouse, the snake found himself captured in a cage, rope cage, and or hemp or something, but there was a mouse also in the cage. And so the snake, instead of eating the mouse, said, "No, let's be friends and everything." And then the mouse could chew his way out of the cage. So he made a hole, and that was the snake. Was, "We'll be friends. He'll chew out. We'll get out. Then I'll eat him." So Lord Vishnu advised they follow this diplomatic maneuver of making friends. Just like the United States and England came together with the Soviet Union to fight Germany. But many people felt in the United States that as soon as Germany was defeated and our armies got to Berlin, we should have kept on going all the way to Moscow. The same logic. But that didn't happen. But this is a diplomatic, but you had people that were, a communist and a capitalist country get together to defeat a common enemy. So this is what they did. They negotiated with Bali, and he was a good idea, because they said, the nectar will come out, but we'll grab it. We'll get it first. So then to churn this ocean, they needed a gigantic churning rod. The churning method was to be, you see this churning method in India still, where you have you're churning milk to get butter or yogurt, and you have a rod, you have a rope wrapped around this rod, and then you pull it. Either it's one person's job, they go back and forth like this, and then at the bottom the paddles rotate like this, and that churns the milk. So this was the same method, but for the churning rod, they needed something big, so it was this Mundara hill. Mundara is one of, around Sumera, there are four large mountains. One of them is Mundara. So they were going to uproot that mountain and carry it to the milk ocean, and then use that as the churning rod. You needed something big. And it was a very heavy mountain because it's made of gold. Vasuki would somehow or other, he gets used all the time as a living rope. He would be the churning rope, and then on one side the demons and one side the demigods. They would like have a tug of war, kind of pull back and forth, and they would churn the ocean. That was the deal. So then all the demigods and the demons go together to Mount Mandara, and with great effort they uproot the thing and they start to carry it. But it's so heavy, it keeps falling, and people get crushed and killed and everything, and it looks like they're not going to bring it there. And then the Lord appears on Garuda. It's an amazing amount, actually, the number of times the Lord makes his appearance in this pastime. Practically he does it all himself, you'll see. So he shows up on Garuda and picks up the mountain and puts it on the back of Garuda, and then Garuda, like a big cargo plane, carries the mountain to the spot, to the correct spot in the ocean. By the way, the Lord also said, it's not just the churning that's going to produce the nectar, but you also have to take them, you have to throw in the milk ocean various herbs and plants and roots and things like that. Because there's got to be some kind of reaction So also there was a herbal formula for this production. So they had to gather all that together too. Then get the churning rod there. And so then when the churning rod got there, and they started to churn. Then the other problem was Vasuki, well, and Garuda had to leave, because as long as Garuda was there, Vasuki wouldn't come, because snakes are Garuda food. As Prabhupada says, Garuda is not a vegetarian. Vasuki couldn't come until Garuda split, so Garuda left. But the Lord was there, actually. He participated in the churning on the side of the demigods. And when Vasuki wrapped himself around the mountain, he very cleverly led the demigods to the head end of Vasuki. Now, Vasuki has lots of heads. He's like what the Greeks call a hydra, you know, the multi-headed snake. They show up in Greek stories too. So he has multi heads, so he leads all the people to the head end. Ajita does this, and so all the demigods go to the head end, and then the demons say, "Wait a minute, why are they at the head? You know, that's the auspicious end, and this is the tail end. This is the inauspicious. This isn't fair, you know." And they went and said, "How do you get the head end?" And so then Ajita says, "Well, okay, you want the head? Go ahead. We can have it. We don't mind." So they switched sides, right? Then they started. Then the mountain began to sink. They couldn't churn and hold it up at the same time. It was too heavy. And that's when the Lord appears as a tortoise, and he gets down at the bottom, and holds up the mountain, which is, as it says here. You imagine the turtle, if your back itches, well, you've got a real problem, because you have this big shell. And so this mountain was, when it was being rotating back and forth like this, was able to scratch his back. So that was getting some pleasure, enjoying in this way. That way he held it up. So he's there on the rope, and he's there. So they go back and forth like this, and then the thing wobbles. The mountain's wobbling back and forth, as you can imagine. So the Lord also appears at the top of the mountain, with millions of arms, with thousands of arms, like another mountain, to stabilize the top. So he's there in that form too, in some thousand-arm form, holding it up at the top, holding it up at the bottom, and actually he's with the demigods. Well, everyone gets tired during this thing. And then the Lord enters them and gives them more energy. Entering the demigods as the energy of the mode of goodness, The demons is the energy of the mode of passion, and Vasuki, who's nearly dead, has the energy in the mode of ignorance, because they're each in different modes. The snake is in the mode of ignorance, and so he gives them energy like that. And the trick of the Lord was that the tail end was really better, because Vasuki was breathing, and he breathes fire. He's a fire-breathing dragon, you know. And so the demigods are, I mean, the demons, they are really, I mean, they look like a forest on fire that's being burned and scorched. But it's so bad that on the other end, they were also getting soot and smoke all over them, and heat and everything. So everyone was quite exhausted. That's why the Lord had to supply them with strength. And then, when the churning became effective, all kinds of things began to come out. Before, the nectar was going to be the last thing to be produced. And I don't remember everything that came out. I'll get the list here from the chapter summary. Quite marvelous things here started to come out. I think the first thing that came out was Uchchaishrava, this horse, a white horse. That came out, And naturally, as these treasures come out of the being churned out of the ocean, everybody wants them.
Yeah.
So they, the Lord said that the demigods don't get too concerned about it, because you know what you really want is the when the Amrita comes out. So this horse, which Chaitrava, which is mentioned in the Bhagavad Gita the poison came first. And they were warned about this, that first, because you separate it out and you kind of get opposites. One is deadly poison and the other is nectar. They have the opposite effects. So the poison came out. That was the deal already, that Lord Shiva would take care of the poison. And so when it began to appear, Lord Shiva then drank up all the poison with his wife's permission. She knew it wouldn't hurt him. And then he got this this blue line on his throat, which became a beauty mark, because he was able to neutralize this poison. And it said, you know, some dripped on the ground, and therefore there's toxic plants and poisonous snakes and scorpions and all these poisonous things in the world come out of this. So then, after Lord Shiva saves the universe. You know, imagine a chemical warfare kind of a poison like that. It was really like a nerve gas or something coming out all over the place. Then the first thing of the churning. I'm sorry, the first thing to come out was Surabhi cow. The Surabhi cow came out, which everybody's very happy because now we can get really great ghee. Surabhi is called Havirdani. She gives Havi. Or ghee. So the Suravi cow came out. Then the horse, which Chaitrava was generated, and that they gave to Bali Maharaj. Everybody's very chivalrous. You take the horse. Because the next thing is the elephant, Airavata, which became Indra's mount, with the four tusks and the multiple trunks and everything, and go anywhere in all direction. And a whole group of she-elephants also appeared. Then the Kastuba gem appeared, and that was taken by Lord Vishnu to wear in his chest. And then a Parijata flower, which grows in the heavenly planets, and it was also like a wish-fulfilling, desire-fulfilling flower, came. And then Apsaras came, the most beautiful girls in the universe, basically the courtesans or prostitutes among the demigods. So all these beautiful, I mean, really good-looking girls came out. And then Lakshmi Devi appeared. And then everybody was really overwhelmed by Lakshmi Devi, and everyone wanted her because she's the goddess of fortune, you know. So she's going to choose her husband. That was the deal. So first they do this Abhishek for Lakshmi Devi, and then she walks around looking at all the guys with a garland, and she puts it around Lord Vishnu, Ajita, and so there becomes his consort. But the demigods, because she had chosen from the other side, they're really depressed now. this really upsets them greatly. But then for them comes Varuni, mm-hmm. The goddess of alcoholic beverages and drunkards. Although she also becomes a consort of Lord Balaram. But Balaram has interesting connections with the lower regents, because he's down there at the bottom also as an Anantashesha. It says that he's worshipped in conjugal love by the daughters of the serpent kings, Shankarshan. That's another interesting, very interesting thing. So they get Varuni, and then everybody's happy, and they start churning again, and then finally, the nectar appears, which is Dhanvantari. Another incarnation of the Lord comes up, the originator of Ayurveda. Ayur means long life, duration of life. So it gives duration of life. So he comes with the jug containing nectar. So even though he's the Lord, the demons grab the nectar and they run with it. And the demigods, oh man, this is like a football game, you know, one side's up, the other side's down, the other side's up. They go back and forth, you know. So then there's a whole big fight. They begin to fight. Well, see, when the demons got it, then they fought around themselves. That's mine. I get it first. I give it to me. You know, they're fighting for it. And then the Lord consoles them and says, okay, I'll take care of this. Then he shows up again as Mohini Murti. So there's been a series of beautiful women and powerful women show up here. The Apsaras, the goddess of fortune, Varuni, and then finally the Lord finally shows up as Mohini Murti. Apparently enormously described as the most beautiful woman in the whole universe. So then, especially the demons are susceptible in this case. And then we go to a whole other pastime of how she, Mohini Murti, they all agreed just under her spell, the glamour of this woman. That, you know, let me distribute it, okay? And so that's how she managed to. The only one demon who got a taste of the nectar managed to snatch some and get a little taste, and he was quickly beheaded. And then the top became Rahu, and the bottom became Ketu. And now they fight with the sun and the moon all the time. That battle's going on. So anyway, that's the summary of that story of this primordial project of churning the milk ocean on a higher level than we know about. So the Lord appears many, many times in this way, but one of the most one is this kurma that he came as a tortoise and held it up. Then is Dhanvantari, as Mohini Murti, and also Ajita, associated with the demigods, is a thousand arm form to balance the whole thing. There's even the energy of strength for all the different participants in this event. Any questions, comments? What a movie this would make, you know, especially if you really got your hand on really good special effects equipment. Yeah.
You mentioned the lower planetary systems, like they're like caves.
They're not like caves, but the lower planetary arena is like a cave. It's like a cave because it's underground. Underground means in the sense that according to the Vedic picture of the world, there's in the middle of the universe this whole disk that spreads out called Bhumandala, of which Jambudvipa is the center, and then the ring islands, of which one is the ocean of milk going out. And so it blocks the sunlight. And it also apparently blocks the astrological influence of the grahas. And so it's dark. There is no sun, there is no seasons. And therefore you do not know, it says, about the passing of time. Time doesn't come. In other words, your karma doesn't come as it usually comes, meted out in small doses by the controlling planets. Rather, everybody's there is really happy and they think there's no karma and everything's good, but every so often what comes down there is Sudarshan Chakra. And apparently it's like a major calamity. Rips through all these heavenly, these hellish planets and causes is like a huge disaster. So that's how they suffer their karma, at least one of the ways.
So it doesn't mean that they're living underground?
They're not exactly living underground, no. It's not underground as we know it. Sataputta has tracked down the old tales and legends of many countries. And there are many, many accounts that appear all over of travelers going underground into a cave, but coming out not just in a cave, but in another world. There are many stories like this. There are many stories like this. How exactly the universe as we see it with our perception is mapped onto this universe that's described, or is how it fits together with the universe that's described in the fifth canto, is something we have to figure out someday. And basically, Prabhupada gave that assignment to the people in the Bhaktivedanta Institute to understand how this actually worked. It's not that there's some conflict. This is not a conflict between, you know, the Bhagavatam and modern science. Rather, this Bhagavatam view is one view of the universe in the Vedas, but there's another view of the universe also in the Jyotish Shastra, which describes the planets as we perceive them, as globes orbiting in space and so on. It's geocentric. It's not heliocentric like the Copernicus system, but nevertheless, it's not like the Bhagavatam, which describes this flat, this mountain in the middle, and stuff we don't see. But just for your information, Prabhupada claims to have seen Mount Meru out of an airplane window while flying over the Alps. So as far as I can tell, that somehow or other this presents the universe the way it is seen by people with more powers of vision than we have. The demigods and the rishis and other exceptional people, that this is the way the universe appears to them. We don't see this Bhumandala, although it does correspond with the plane of the ecliptic, which is an imaginary plane going out into space. You draw a line around the Earth, and that line is the ecliptic. It's the sun moves to the north and moves to the south to produce the seasons, and the middle of that line is called the ecliptic. And is that right? Yeah, it's the path that the sun falls around the earth over the year, the ecliptic, and you project that out into space. That actually corresponds to Bhumandala. But we don't see this Bhumandala stretching out there. We don't see these other things. Nobody recently has visited, you know, Bila Svarga. But anyway, that's the story.
Mm-hmm. Just one thing I noticed, Sariputta mentions that if you put the Yojana to something like 6 miles, then the ring-shaped islands describes...
Yeah.
In the fifth canto, correspond almost exactly to the orbits of the planets, as you know them.
Yeah, and then he does mathematical operations to show that the chances of this happening by accident are vanishingly, infinitesimally small. Yeah, that's a very interesting discovery of Sariputta's. The Yojana is based on so many hastas. And the hasta varies from place and place and time to time, and so different scriptures give different lengths, modern lengths for yojanas. So that's why you can take them, and so one way to find out what is the yojana actually, since it was just an approximate measure, was when he found her. I don't think it was 6 miles. I think I forgot what it was, but
8 miles.
No, not 8.
Prabhupada usually gives 8, but it's smaller than 8.
Five and a half or 6.
So, yeah, but they're all different. There's a range of figures given in different texts like that. So when he got it to a certain, within the range, with one of the numbers given in the Vedas, then there was an incredible lineup between the orbits of the planets and the ring islands. Yeah.
Another question, maybe not related totally to the subject, but you're relating the different species of asuras and demigods that was going to different parts of the universe. But There's also this book called Proof of a Vedic Culture's Global Existence. Mm-hmm. In that book, all these pieces are kind of related to what happens on this earth. So I was just wondering, does that have any contact with reality, or is it total speculation?
What's in that book?
For example, it says that after the Great Deluge, those races that were following the good forces in nature moved to the east, and those who were following the demoniac nature, they moved to the west.
I don't know where he got that information from, Srinandanandana. I have to ask him. I know him quite well, but I haven't gone through all that book. And he takes some things from very authorized sources, but some of his sources are not universally accepted, like P.N. Oakes and things like that. I have doubts about those things. I would probably be a little more critical about my sources than he is. When you get down at least to the details, I'm not quite sure. Earth is it's actually between these two. There's the Earth. It's like Middle Earth. it's Middle Earth and. It's contested territory. I mean, both demigods, just as demigods descend to the earth, they used to come quite often, up until Buddha's time. But in Kali Yuga, Earth became less and less attractive. But people used to see them. Every literature, traditional literature, reports these people. They used to mingle with human society, and quite often mate together and produce, you know, heroes and things like that. Men of amazing strength or women of incredible beauty, like that, like Helen of Troy, and so these. These are there. Now we don't see them anymore, the demigods. It says during Maharaj Prithu's reign, whenever he performed sacrifice, even the ordinary person could see the demigods. So people don't see them anymore. And so again, they're dismissed as imagination, the nursery time of the human race, imagining all these things. One scholar thinks that people's minds were constituted differently. He speculates like this, that consciousness as we know it now was not developed. This was a late development. Of evolution, and people were basically their minds were constituted, so they're basically kind of schizophrenic. They had visions and heard voices and had visions which they could not tell whether they came from the inside or the outside. Like what you see in a schizophrenic, that was like the normal human condition, and they produced all these stories. He called it, what's his name? The Origin of Consciousness and the Bicameral Mind, that our minds were just split and we're just running around being dictated to by this unconscious without any... far out speculation. Trying to account for the fact that this was how everybody saw the world. And he can't think that maybe it was a quite different world from what it is now. The German poet Schiller remarked, he also, people began to discover as the Enlightenment progressed, and also the anti Enlightenment, it became full blown what they call the Romantic movement. And one of them was Schiller. And they were looking to go back to the earlier times and to the earlier civilization where things were whole, because you know the effect of industrial development and capitalism was really destroying human society as everyone had ever known it, and so people wanted to go back to a simpler time, a return to rural bliss and so on like that. And so they began to investigate more and more the pre-industrial early culture as maybe some kind of ideal. People began to think of the Renaissance as a mistake. Before the Enlightenment, there was the Renaissance, which we were always taught. That's when we really came out of the darkness and started to... I had one professor say the Renaissance meant human vision shifted from God to man to matter. There was a shift in human vision that began at the Renaissance. But there were thinkers in the 19th century who began to describe the Renaissance as a second fall. You know, the first fall when Adam ate the apple. The Renaissance was the second fall. And before there was a God-centered, organic, harmonious, they kind of idealized the Middle Ages somewhat. And people were trying to go back even further. So one of these was Schiller. So he made the remark after studying all these different ancient works again. He said, in the days when the gods were more human, men were more divine. Meaning the gods appeared, walked among us, and things like that. He said, men were more divine. And this is the case. As actually describes it, when people were of a higher quality, then it was worth the demigods to come and associate with us. But now, why go? It's just like, why do you know tourists don't go to Sarajevo anymore? It used to be a nice place. Now, where's the tourists, you know? So the demigods don't come here anymore. But if the Hare Krishna movement is successful, then they'll start coming back again. There'll be people to visit. Okay, we should stop now. Thank you very much. Srila Prabhupada ki jai.